Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome everyone to the very first episode of Continuing Mission, our look at the ways in which fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, Christopher Jones, and the primary focus of this show will be on the fan series, or as I prefer to call them, independent productions, that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe. Many Star Trek fans are creative professionals, actors, writers, effects designers, many of whom worked on the shows that have graced our screens for the past 5 decades, and the work they're now producing out of their sheer love for Star Trek is amazing. We want to share this work with you through an inside look at the most vibrant fandom Hollywood has ever known. Along the way, we may also explore other ways that Star Trek is being constantly expanded through games, art, and more. But first, we begin with Star Trek Continues. The series recently released its second episode, and as we record this, shooting has begun on the third. Without question, the Enterprise is as much a character in Star Trek as any captain, commander, or lieutenant. And if you've seen Star Trek Continues, you know just how spot on the space scenes featuring the 1701 are. So I'm very pleased to have with me tonight the man behind those scenes and so many of the visuals you love, from TNG through Enterprise, Academy Award winning designer, Doug Drexler. Doug, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for taking some time to talk to me tonight.
Oh, hey, thank you for having me on board. I really appreciate it.
It's always great to talk to you, and I was watching Star Trek Continues recently, and we actually had some of the cast and crew on the Ready Room to talk about the show, and you know, they pointed out, and of course I knew as I'm watching as well, that you had worked on the exterior shots of the Enterprise in that episode. And
right.
The Enterprise is such a character on the show, the work that you did on there, you know, really helped to bring alive the feel of that show as part of the original series. And so today I wanted to talk to you about independent productions and the work that you do on those.
Yes, it's really pretty amazing, isn't it? What's going on?
It's really amazing.
Because of technology, people can practically go toe-to-toe with the studios. If you've got a digital camera, and an HD camera is like nothing to get these days, and you've got an editing suite, and you've got other people who are interested. See, the thing about Star Trek is there's so many passionate people who are just so excited to get involved and want to live the experience of making a Star Trek episode. Many of them have been done at this point, and it really boggles the mind. I was involved very early. There wasn't even a YouTube when I was getting involved the fan stuff. The thing you have to remember is that I'm a fan, and who ended up working in Hollywood and working on Star Trek for many years. But the thing was that before that, I used to do illustrations for fanzines, you know, in the 70s. Fanzines were the internet. There was no internet. I was doing all of this stuff, but it was much more primitive. I mean, we didn't have computers at the time, if you can believe that. I mean, to some people, there have always been computers. But in a way, I feel kind of lucky to have straddled those two eras, you know, the period where there was no internet, there were no computers. Right. Everything you did, it was more of a physical kind of thing. You either actually drew it or sculpted it or printed it out on paper or did 8mm movies, and, you know. Hey, I can't seem to shut up.
Well, let me ask you, mentioned the fanzines and such. Now, I believe, correct, that you and a friend of yours in New York, I think it was it in the 70s that you actually had a Star Trek store that you had opened up in the city?
Yeah, it was the Federation Trading Post, and it's kind of becoming a legendary at this point. There was that period of time, Star Trek was canceled like in 69, and the Federation Trading Post, I guess, was 74 or something like that. I guess so. It, you know, when you're in your early 20s, 4 years seems like a huge amount of time. So by the time we opened up the Federation Trading Post, it seemed like Star Trek had been off the air forever. But it really wasn't that long, was it? Yeah, but the thing was is that there was nothing at the time. There were a couple of model kits. There was Stephen Whitfield's landmark book, The Making of Star Trek, which started careers. I mean, for me, that book was an epiphany to read it. I mean, I was a pretty well-read kid, and I was literate. I read all the, you know, science fiction and read up on filmmaking as well. But if you look at The Making of Star Trek, and you imagine, I mean, knowing that there's no internet, you can't just go on Google and type in your favorite show and find sites that show them working and how things were done.
Right.
That wasn't available at all. So a book like The Making of Star Trek, you flip through that book, and I mean, like I was 12 or 13 years old. I was reading production schedules and call sheets and budgets and outlines for scripts and sketches. And it exploded in my brain, you know. All of a sudden, I had the big picture of how something like this got done. And I think that from that moment on, I always kind of moved in this direction, you know, where I ended up, even if I didn't realize what I was doing or even knew how to do it.
And how did you end up actually working on the franchise? Now, I know that as a kid, I believe you told us about this when you were with us on Warp 5 last year to talk about designing the Nexo-1 and all, that you had to negotiate TV time with your parents, I guess, so you could watch Star Trek.
Yeah.
The idea that you were like that as a kid, I mean, it's amazing that as a kid, you love this TV show, you love this franchise, and then as an adult, you work on it, not only work on it, but you're one of the most influential designers. You designed, ships that people love. It must be like a dream come true.
I did it all really to get revenge on my parents.
Is that why?
Not really. I'm only kidding.
How do you go from being a fan to actually having an office there on the lot and you're actually working on this franchise?
It is kind of crazy. It is kind of a Cinderella story. And the further I get away from the genesis of, you know, my thinking I could do this sort of thing, the more amazing it really gets even to me. I mean, I lived on the East Coast. I wasn't even in Los Angeles. Like you said, as a kid, I wasn't allowed to watch TV for a while, but I was a big science fiction geek, and I read everything. I mean, I read all the classics. And when this show was on, I knew it had premiered, but I wasn't allowed to watch it. And I'd heard about it from my friends at school, and I think Star Trek was on Thursday nights at that point, and it was a Thursday night, and my mother was taking a shower, so I snuck downstairs and turned on the TV. And it was, I think it was This Side of Paradise. And I watched the last half of This Side of Paradise. And that was it. It was like I had taken a shot of heroin or something. You know, it was like I went on strike. I mean, I had to watch the show. And basically, I was given an hour. Now, there's a part of me that wonders, well, maybe I was so crazy about it because it was kept from me. But you know how you want what you can't have. But it really wasn't. I always was a huge science fiction geek and was always sketching and drawing and doing stuff like that. It was just when I watched it and I'd seen other shows on television. And look, I'm a Lost in Space fan. I enjoy it. It's very nostalgic for me, and I'll watch it today.
Yeah.
You know, I love the robot and Dr. Smith. You know,
I used to watch it growing up as well.
I have a B9 robot in my office, believe it or not.
Really?
If you go to my Facebook page, there's an album where you can see I've got a B9 robot in my office, and I've got an Uncle Martin ship in my garage, full size.
Now, are you like me, and when you sense trouble, do you yell, danger, danger?
Well, doesn't everybody? Even people who don't know what the hell it means do it.
When I was in university, our call in, I lived in an international house, and there were 12 of us in the house, but the shower was, it was like a community shower, and then you had the toilets. But if you flushed the toilets, all the hot water, actually all the cold water would go away, and you would get scorched.
Yeah.
And so that was our call sign in the house. And if someone was going to flush the toilet, they yelled, "Danger, danger, Will Robinson," so that anyone in the shower could move out of the way.
I'm pretty sure that's just the way it was on the Jupiter 2 as well. That when someone flushed the toilet, it probably caused a pressure drop on the entire ship. I mean, I bet.
So how did you actually get the job on the show itself?
Well, I mean, the thing was, I got into the business because of makeup. I discovered makeup when I was about 24 years old, I guess. And at that time, like I said, there was no internet. So there were a few magazines that had information on how stuff was done. And one of them was Cine Fantastique. But the one that really was hugely instrumental in me, you know, getting going was Cinemagic, which later became a Fangoria magazine, but it used to be a pretty slick fanzine. And there were articles in there on how to do all kinds of stuff. And it was Halloween, and I got invited to a Halloween party. And I remembered that one of the articles in the Cinemagic was how to do foam latex, how to sculpt an appliance, how to make a mold, that type of thing. So I said, okay, that's it. I'm doing that. And I'd never sculpted before. And I first made the molds, did a life cast of a friend who I was going to do a Planet of the Apes makeup. I mean, that's what everybody did then, was do Planet of the Apes, because that movie was so influential. I mean, it just killed everybody's brain, you know. People, how many people who were makeup artists were influenced by the John Chambers stuff? I got into makeup, and things took off for me. I met a wonderful guy, makeup artist, who we became partners, John Caglione, and we worked together for like 12 or 13 years and had tons of fun. And we ended up getting, against all odds, Dick Tracy. Warren Beatty is not your average bear, and he wanted somebody other than, the go-to guys that everybody went to, and we were different. So we ended up getting the job. Plus, we knew a few people who were on Dick Tracy. We worked together earlier, so we ended up getting that job. That brought us to Los Angeles. Once we got out here, because of Dick Tracy, we were able to get into the union. Once we were in the union, I knew that when we were done with Tracy, if I wanted to, I could conceivably work on Star Trek. Up until then, I couldn't, because there's a New York union and there's a West Coast and an East Coast union. And you just can't come from New York, and they'd have to either give you a special permit, or you'd have to take your union test for the West Coast, which they made Dick Smith do on, I think it was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. They made one of the greatest makeup artists who ever lived take his West Coast test. But, okay,
so Dick, follow the rules.
Yeah. So, Dick Tracy ended, and I knew that, third season Star Trek was about to start up right across the town there. And I made a beeline there and literally begged Mike Westmore to let me work on the show. And that was it. I was on, and I worked doing makeup.
But at this point, you're begging Mike Westmore someone with Oscar award in your hand.
Please let me. He said, "What do you want to do television for?" He said, you could do features. Everybody thinks that's, listen, even Mike ended up doing mostly television, although he did, consult on features and do features here and there. But I love television. I prefer TV. I'd rather work on television than a movie. I did movies for 12, 13 years. And I did that. I don't want to do it. Television is much warmer. You make more friends that you stay with for long periods of time. Movies are like nomadic. And honestly, to be truthful, I found you're more likely to get your back stabbed on a movie than you are on a TV show, because you'll get people who they know they're probably never going to see you again. If they have to throw you under the bus to save themselves, they will. On television, not that that doesn't happen, but you end up getting a group of people who, you know what it's like to work somewhere and you're familiar with everybody, and it's just a much, much, that's why Star Trek was like one giant family. And what do I miss? Well, I miss Star Trek. I miss working on Star Trek. But what I really miss is, our group. Mike and Denise Okuda, Herman, Zimmerman, John Eaves, all the people that we worked with, the physical effects. It was a well-oiled machine. After that many years, that I really miss, and I mourn that. On the other hand, Star Trek closing down when it did was a good thing for me, because I ended up going on to Battlestar Galactica for Gary Hutzel. And I've been with Gary ever since then. And we've won Emmy Awards, and we've been nominated many times, and get to do incredible, incredible stuff every day. And so, you know, it's kind of a funny feeling. I feel bad about the show ending. And on the other hand, I see the good things that happened to me because it did end.
Well, let me ask you, you talked about TV and film, and of course you worked on Star Trek all the way through, and through DS9 and through Enterprise. And now let's talk about Star Trek Continues, because it's the most recent thing that you've done related to Star Trek on screen anyway. Yeah. And but because now these are episodes like a TV show, but because it's an independent production, you know, they're not churning them out every week like CBS Paramount was in the days of Star Trek on television. How is that compared to working on a TV series versus a film? Is it somewhere in the middle? Because you know these people and you're going to work with them again down the road, but it's not that same daily activity like you had before.
Well, it's not the same stress level. You know, the thing is that, one, you're not getting paid, okay? You're just doing it because you want to. There's like no profit happening here. You do it because you're passionate about it. I'm passionate about it. I always have been. Can I explain it? I'm not sure. I don't know why. I always feel compelled to be involved with this thing. I feel like a part of the Roddenberry family. And I feel like it's partly my job to protect Star Trek. I know Mike Okuda feels the same way. That Star Trek is, yes, you're right. It belongs to Paramount Pictures. But there's actually, it's hard to describe. There's a sense of ownership, and not that we have any ownership of the show, but it goes beyond legal. You know what I mean? It goes beyond a contract or getting paid or anything like that. Our DNA is attuned to this project for some crazy reason.
Right. It's like protecting a child, right? You feel like you've, in a sense, it's very true for you, because you worked on Star Trek from the TNG days. And, you know, the vast majority of Star Trek's content came after that point. It is like you and everyone else have raised this franchise, this child, creatively. And so you feel that need to continue to nurture and protect that.
You know, part of what was wonderful about Star Trek is that while it was a network-type show, it was known for kind of bucking the system, that Star Trek would work at doing stuff that might be controversial. They might do stories that some people might not like, or that go against the beliefs of certain areas of the country. And Star Trek was known for making statements. And that's one of the things I loved about Star Trek. And I was always proud that Star Trek, a science fiction show, which was looked down upon in the 60s, would make statements that are still reverberating today. I mean, I think that Star Trek...
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the original series now, and you see a multinational, multiracial crew, okay? Now, today, that doesn't seem like anything. But believe me, in 66, that was so unusual. I mean, Star Trek wasn't the first one. I Spy with Bill Cosby and Robert Culp was before Star Trek. And I think that Bill Cosby was one of the first major black stars on a television show, a feature player. But for some parts of the country, seeing all of those different races on the bridge was shocking. Believe it or not, I think back on it, I mean, people, you know what? We really have come a long way, because there was a lot of, you know, foolishness going on back then. I knew it. That's why one of the reasons Star Trek was so appealing to me. There was nothing. The show bucked racism. Yeah. They bucked Vietnam. They did shows that spoke out against Vietnam at a time where you know, the census probably didn't even realize it, you know, private little war.
Yeah, probably not. That's why it got on, right?
Yeah.
The censors just kind of went over their heads.
It would go over their heads, or they just don't look that close, you know, mm-hmm. when you got a lot of stuff to do. Or maybe you're lazy that day. I don't know. They got away with a lot.
Well, they're too concerned about something like if a white and black person are going to kiss on the screen, right? They're more worried about that than commentary on a bigger issue.
On the other hand, though, I have to say that Mark Cushman's books that are coming out now, Mark has done something so unbelievable. I mean, he's done a document on the production of a TV show like I have never seen in my life. And the things that impressed me the most when I was reading the first one was that NBC was not as dumb as Gene Roddenberry made them out to be. Was it Ben Robinson? There was the representative of NBC who would get all the scripts and send in notes. And there's a lot of his notes, which you never saw in the making of Star Trek. And he made a lot of good sense. And that NBC really would bite the bullet and know that they were making, you know, a statement. The thing that I learned about Gene is that he knew how to create a sense of, in the fans, people of ownership and love. You know, people love underdogs, and people love to see somebody bucking the system. So when Gene would tell stories about how I stood up because the network thinks the schmucks like you in the television audience are too stupid, you know, and the audience laughs, that really wasn't that true. But he knew that by saying that, it kind of made him, you know, kind of heroic in a way. And it captured people's imaginations. It was a period of rebellion. I mean, the 60s, stuff that was going on then. This, you know, college students who were part of demonstrations against Vietnam War and stuff like that. When Gene would talk that way, he sounded like, you know, someone who was, I mean, those were Gene's ideals. But if he could make it look like he was the underdog and he was being taken advantage of, the network just didn't understand him. It built him up. It worked amazingly, but I have to say that through Cushman's books, I've learned that NBC was a lot smarter and a lot more supportive than we were originally led to believe.
The most recent episode of Star Trek Continues, Lolani, which you worked on, it carries that torch. It really does deliver a message about women's rights, about freedoms and slavery, with the story about the Orion slave girl, Lolani. And you did the work on that too. How did you come to actually be involved with this particular project as Star Trek Continues?
Well, I mean, in Star Trek circles, I'm fairly well known. And Vic,
I think you're extremely well known. Very, very modest. People kind of know who I am.
Well, okay, if you say so. I'm extremely well known, by the way, everyone. but you see, the thing was that Vic knew who I was, Vic Montana. Yeah. And I think Jack Marshall was working with him. Now, Jack is one of the founders of New Voyages. I'm one of the founders of New Voyages. James Cawley is one of the founders of New Voyages. And then James had his group of people up there in upstate New York that got things done for him. But this is a whole nother story, and it's a really interesting one. But the thing is that Vic contacted me through Jack, and we got together. Oh, no. And you know what? I think I had met Vic once before through Alec Peters. But the thing was that I got together with Vic. He wanted me to do visual effects for the show. He knew that I, you know, I love the Enterprise, and you know, it's one of my girlfriends. What can I say? And the thing was that at that point, I had vowed that I wasn't going to do any more fan stuff because they can be very difficult sometimes, and I work almost all the time as it is. So I don't have a lot of time to put up with, you know, rough seas. And rough seas can happen on any production, and they do in real life too. I mean, fan films aren't that different from the real thing, except that there are real deadlines. You get your, I mean, you have to I can't even, sometimes we'll talk about what it's like to work on a TV show. It's exciting and thrilling and, you know, scare the pants off you, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Vic came over and he wanted me to do it. And I said, you know, I said I was never going to do that again and I'm not doing it anymore. And I haven't done it in a while. And he was, Vic was always very cordial about it and understood and everything like that, but he never would stop asking. And the thing was that, and I think Jack came up with this about doing a sequence in the teaser for the first one, The Pilgrims of Eternity, the one with Mike Forrest playing Apollo.
Yeah.
Where I would be Paladin from Have Gun Will Travel, which is another show that's very dear to my heart, and it's tied directly to Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry learned to write on Have Gun Will Travel. He wrote 24 episodes of it. And you could take Paladin, the hero, who was a guy, he was San Francisco based, which is why Starfleet is in San Francisco. And he was kind of a mercenary. He was a hired gun. He would go out, someone would pay his fee, and he would go out and he'd solve problems. And he was, anyway, Vic knew, I have a Paladin outfit. I mean, I've got the holster with the silver chest piece on it, and I've got, you know, the single action army Colt that's, a 6-inch single action army Colt. And I've got a shirt I made from one of Richard Boone shirts that I got a hold of. I got the whole thing. I got the hat made by the same people who made the original hat. If you're on my Facebook page, you'll see it. Please.
I've seen these photos.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who's listening, if you want to go, just friend me. And I've got a ton of stuff in the album section. So he offered, he said, Jack took a segment of one of the Have Gun Will Travels where, you know, Paladin says, I'd like you to take a look at this gun. He gives this little thing about this gun, how it's handcrafted and blah, blah, blah. And that was clever, you know, and I was like, yeah, I'd like to do that. So we agreed I'd do that. But I said, but I'm not doing any visual effects. If you think this is going to get me to do visual effects, you've got another thing coming. And, you know, it's like, no, not at all. So we shot the thing and, he came over to show it to me, and it turned out really great. We did some looping in my Vic is, you know, he's a voice guy in anime as well. He's very successful.
Oh yeah,
you know, I went to a convention.
He does
once.
Pokemon and stuff too.
Oh,
right?
He does all kinds of stuff. I went to a convention once where he was on stage having nothing to do with Star Trek, and the place was full. It was a 4,000 seat capacity. You know, so the guy's a pro. I mean, I watched him on set, and he's got a good. He knows how to direct actors. Anyway, the thing turned out real good, but and also, of course, I was very interested in it because Mike Forrest, Apollo, is in it. He's a dear friend of mine, and I thought it was a great idea to have him back. And Mike is a tremendous actor. I mean, what a voice. And so I watched the rough cut that he had, and I said, holy crap. I go, who's your DP? Holy, you know, I mean, it's like, it's, and Vic was terrific as Kirk. I mean, I could squint my eyes and it was William Shatner.
I'll tell you, I'm sitting here watching Star Trek Continues and I had them playing a couple of weeks ago because we were having them on the show. And because I've, at that moment, I'm not like staring at it continuously. I have a display right here on my desktop. And like you say, there are moments where I don't even think about that it's Vic. It's like it's William Shatner.
Yeah.
And he's not doing a caricature of Shatner.
No.
It's just, he's just capturing the spirit of who Kirk is.
Yes.
And
that's the difference between someone who is just playing actor and someone who really has some chops.
Right. And the look and feel of the show too is so spot on TOS that I almost felt like, well, I did feel like, I shouldn't even say almost, I did feel like I'm watching an episode of the original series.
Absolutely.
That I've only seen once before.
Yeah, it was startling when I watched it. Now Matt Busey does the DP work and he's a brilliant guy. I mean, he totally understands the camera and he's technically a very good guy with the camera and the lighting and the types of camera moves. You know, for me, showing how clever you are by using a Steadicam sort of rig while shooting a show that's supposed to be a Star Trek episode from the 60s, it's going to hurt you. the minute you do that type of thing, it just doesn't look like Star Trek anymore. And the same goes for when I did the visual effects. All the shots. You know, I had done some New Voyages stuff in my spare time. And I know how seductive it is to try to make it do things it didn't do before. I mean, I barrel roll the Enterprise, you know? and I really love a couple of those. I mean, I haven't seen much of the New Voyages. We did In Harm's Way, which I still think is such a fun episode. I just love it. It's really fun. You know, there's a part of me that says, wow, it'd be fun to redo it. You know, get the gang back together and redo that one and do it, you know, sleeker. Because it was, you know, it was rough, but that was a long time ago. We didn't even distribute it. There was no YouTube. I told you, you had to go to like a site to download it.
Yeah.
And we also did one called Center Seat, which I really loved. And that was the first one I actually put my real name on because I thought it was that good. But when I did Star Trek Continues, I told Vic, I said, look, I will do this because I'm so excited about how it looks. I'm only doing the ship shots, although I have gotten involved with other shots like the hangar deck sequence in Leilani. I totally went off. Dan Dodd started it and I took it and lit it and it turned out beautiful. I mean, I look at it and I'm critical of my own work and I go, wow, that looks like the old show. But that, for me, that's what it's all about now. To not try to do what they could have done or not try to fix the things that didn't work or, you know what I mean?
Right.
I don't want to do it with very little grain. I want lots of grain on the ship. You know, I'm going to have less grain and it's going to be cleaner and sharper looking, but I want to do it just the way they did. When I set out to set up shots where it photographed the same way as the 11-foot model, I found out from shooting it for years, you know, because I always had a model of the Enterprise, that it never quite looked the same. Well, surprise, I mean, one of the things that just isn't obvious, and it took me years to even figure out, it wasn't until I was working on, I think we were doing first or second season remaster on TNG, and I was there for one of the years. It really didn't need a lot of CG because Paramount saved all the original elements, which was absolutely amazing. But there were a couple where I had to set up a CG ship to replace a shot that was missing or they couldn't find. They usually found it after I got the shot done.
Of course.
And I would go to line up the Enterprise DCG model, and I just couldn't. Well, first I talked to Gary Hutzel, who shot a lot of those shows, you know, shot the ship, who I work with now. And I said, Gary, what lenses did you use? And Gary told me what lenses he used. I go back, I use those lenses.
Oh, that's a great resource that you could ask.
Yeah. I went and set up the lenses, and the ship just did not look the same at all. I'm like, what the hell am I missing here? And it like hit me like a ton of bricks. And it was the centerpiece of how I would approach all the shots for Star Trek Continues. And that is, everybody who does a Star Trek show in CG, the first thing they do is make the ship 947 feet long, if it's the TOS Enterprise. If it's a TNG Enterprise, they make their model 2,000 feet long. Well, there's no way it's going to look the same, because the ship that they shot on television wasn't 2,000 feet long. It was 11 feet long. And I'm like, holy shit, how come that never, oh my God, that never occurred to me. And I would run and try it. I take my ship, and I'd make it 11 feet long, and all of a sudden, bingo, snapped right in. Holy cow, that was the secret all along. Well, of course, that's only a part of the secret. I mean, the thing is, on Star Trek Continues, okay, I now had the plan to shoot an 11-foot CG model and not a 1,000-foot CG model. The other thing was, I would base all shots on existing shots that they already had. It would start off looking like an original shot, but then I could change the camera a little bit towards the end and people's brains would go, wow, new shot.
Right.
The other thing was the lighting. Everybody lights the ships closer to reality, you know, like a single star with some fill and maybe a little bit of bounce from a planet, you know. Uh-huh. Well, that doesn't look like the show either. I took my ship, I set it up, I figured out what the lenses were for TOS by working with an 11-foot ship and changing the lenses until the foreshortening on the ship resembled what they had on the original show. And then I took a lot of time looking at the pictures of Howard Anderson and Westheimer and saying, what was their lighting setup? Because you know that on the original show, the Enterprise was always lit evenly and had multiple shadows on it. And that was because they needed shots to be able to be used in any situation because they couldn't shoot new shots for every situation. A shot from episode 3 needed to be reused in episode 12 and still fit in. You know, it couldn't go from stark lighting to, you know, right, very dark lighting. They didn't have that kind of money. So they, over the 3 years, they had developed, you know, a resource of stock footage, and then where they could afford it, they would get a new shot if it was absolutely necessary to help tell a story, and only then. So I wanted to approach the show, and Vic absolutely did as well. We spoke a lot about it. He's a true fan, and he really understands the original show, obviously. So the thing was to shoot everything exactly as if we were going into real fourth season production.
Right.
If I was going to do shots, and this is how I explained it to Vic, if I had Bob Justman sitting in the room here with us right now, he's going to say, do whatever you want, but those shots must fit into what we already have. So my shots had to fit flawlessly with the original series shots.
Yeah, and they really look like that. And when we had Chuck White, we had Chuck Huber, we had Larry Nemechek, and we had Todd Habercorn on Ready Room recently to talk about this. And one thing that Chris White was talking about was actually the way they all described Star Trek Continues is that it's a museum quality reproduction of the original series, which I took as being what you're describing here, that creatively, like you said, you're resisting that urge to make it more modern, and you're making sure that it does feel, as you just said, like it's the fourth season of the original series, yeah, and it's the same production crew and production values.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that bothered me about the remastered shots is, for instance, they would fix stuff. And that would always be the first reaction to anybody, and who's doing it, especially if you don't know the show as well as, say, someone like me, who loves the fact that the Enterprise sometimes crab flies, you know, catty corner. It doesn't fly exactly on its center line. It kind of slides a little bit. To me, that's part of the charm of the way the ship flew. And to take that out is to take away from that charm. And it also subliminally says that you think what they did was crap. You know? Hey,
yeah,
listen,
the thing is,
now let me say, I don't mean to, you know, run over you here, but the thing I want to say is that anybody who's listening who worked on the remasters, I'm not criticizing you guys. Know that I understand that you get your marching orders from all over the place. And maybe the studio doesn't want that. They'll say, I'm sorry, but it looks like it's sliding. I don't want you to do that. And you can't do
right.
it. You know? So just, I have to say that. Okay.
Well, I think all of us as creatives have that experience. You know, now I don't do visual effects, but I am a professional designer, and I will design something as well. And like you just said, you know, the client will come back and say, I don't want it to look like that. I don't want this element here. And you feel like it should be, but at the end of the day,
well,
they're calling the shots. And so you have to make that change.
The beauty of working on Star Trek Continues is that, okay, number one, I'm not getting paid. Okay.
Right.
I'm not getting paid. Well, what I'm getting for payment is doing it the way I want. And I make that clear. I made that clear in the beginning. And Vic was always amenable to that. He was, it's however I feel it should be, that's the way it's going to be. And so under those conditions, I'm okay to work. I'm more than okay to work on Star Trek Continues. I'm very proud of Star Trek Continues. I think it's absolutely amazing. I feel like I'm getting, it's so much like the original show. It just blows me away. I mean, it's crazy, man, crazy.
It really, really is. Well, let's talk about one other thing that's not related to the screen. Now, many people have seen, they're familiar with the beautiful starships that you do for the Ships of the Line calendar. And kind of related to that kind of work, The Fall, the big book series The Fall came out last autumn. And I won't give away when it happens in the literature, but at some point, for those who haven't read all the books, the Terok-Nor Deep Space Nine station from the television series is destroyed, and a new station is built by Starfleet. And that station, we see it for the first time on the cover of David R. George III's novel Revelation in Dust. And we had David on Literary Treks a while back to talk about that book, and he talked quite a bit about the process of creating this new station and working with you on the visual design as well. And as just a diehard Niner myself, I really wanted to hear from you how you approached designing that station. And because you worked on Deep Space Nine, did you have a list of things about the Terok-Nor design that you had wanted to tackle from a Starfleet perspective for a long time? What was your approach on this?
Well, I mean, I had always, you know, wondered about, what if Starfleet restored this place? I never looked at it from the point of view of, you know, that it would be destroyed and have to be replaced. But what would a Starfleet version? And actually, the thing was that I think in Beyond the Stars, the one where Sisko plays a 1950s science fiction writer, there's a version of DS9 on the cover that Jim Vanover did of a book that is DS9 1950s
yes.
Air Force kind of style.
And, yeah, it's really cool.
And we always wonder, now, what would Starfleet, you know, do with this? There was a point where DS9 looked a lot more like a Starfleet station than a Cardassian station. When Rick first, now Rick did the original design with Herman Zimmerman and Rick Berman. At that point, it had kind of a smooth surface and was kind of Starfleet-ish because Rick is a very Starfleet kind of guy. Two set designers and with input from everybody in the department took elements of the interior sets that were being designed and applied them to the exterior of Deep Space Nine. And then it started to take on a Cardassian look. But the idea of it, you know, if Starfleet built this, what would it look like? Now, the thing is that if Starfleet were to really rebuild it for no other reason than to have a space station, it probably wouldn't look the way it ended up looking, which is a lot, in many ways, like the Deep Space Nine.
But, yeah, it's definitely inspired by the original look of
the
Cardassian station.
What's going on here, the station was destroyed, and it was a catastrophe. And so the new station celbrates the old station. It looks the way it does because we don't want to forget the old station that met such an awful fate. And so in a way, it's a memorial to the original Deep Space Nine. Now, in the days of Star Trek, Roddenberry used to talk about something he called technology unchained. And what that means is that something doesn't have to look the way it does because it has to follow the rules of form follows function. Form follows function is important, but not as important as it used to be. You could go for beauty and design. A Starfleet vessel, starship has to look a certain way in its configuration because it affects the warp bubble around the ship. But if you're going to do the station, you could design it more like architecturally, like a building on Earth, and give it a certain look. So we knew that we wanted, and this was working with the writer and the editors, that first, one thing I should say now is that they had a very strong idea right up front what they wanted it to look like. They didn't know how to express it because they're not designers and illustrators, but they could say, well, we want to have the arms. So we knew that the basic configuration, what it was going to look like. And we came to an agreement on a basic configuration that reflected Deep Space Nine and that they liked and that we could live with as well. One thing that is important to remember is that this design wasn't done like you would do it on a TV show where you might spend months going through different designs. This was done in a matter of weeks. Now, I'm I'm very busy on Defiance, and I really didn't have time to, basically, I supervised it and organized it. I said, okay, I got a Starfleet space station here. I want it to feel like Starfleet. Who can I get who, I love their work. They are Starfleet. They are Starfleet. Uh-huh. And that guy is Andy Probert. Now, I love working with Andy, and he's a genius. I mean, I'm so floored by the work that he does. And so I brought in Andy. And so Andy got all the notes, and all the rough sketches, and had questions, and he went about doing sketches, which you could see on my Facebook page. I actually have a section on the new DS9 space station. It has all of Andy's sketches that he did. And so with those sketches and the writer and the editors, certain elements were approved. And from that point, Andy made a very rough CG mock-up so it could, the proportions could be seen from different angles. Once that was approved, I have a crazy friend of mine named Douglas Graves. Some of you, I'm sure, already know who he is. He's a terrific 3D modeler. It's a funny thing. Dag, who's been with us for years now, I met him because of the Drex Files, the website that I had on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've met a lot of people because of the internet. And I saw Dag's work, and I was like, whoa, who is this guy? And it turned out not only was he really talented and doing work that I really liked, but he was crazy. He's funny as hell. I mean, we laugh all the time. And he ended up working with us, and he's worked with us through Battlestar Galactica, Blood and Chrome, and Caprica, and into the Defiance. So Dag and I are buddies, and I took all of Andy's stuff, handed him over to Dag. Dag did models, and to me, I'd make suggestions, and that's how it came to be. Usually, I lay out the book covers. As a matter of fact, I always lay out the book covers. I've been lucky to have a really wonderful relationship with Simon & Schuster, and they give me a lot of book covers to do. I've been very lucky.
Yeah,
there.
They're very beautiful.
Sometimes it's crazy, and I'll get a call on Thursday and say, oh, God, we really need something tomorrow, you know? And sometimes some really good stuff comes out of being, you know, having to do something overnight. But that's how the design came to be. It's very collaborative, you know? It was fun watching Andy do Starfleet.
Did you have a feel? One thing that David talked about was that he originally, a lot of people often ask, why does Starfleet put the bridge of the starship, the command center, right on the top of the saucer where it's so vulnerable to attack? And David talked about he wanted to bury the command center in the middle of the station and call it the core. But during the process of actually, you know, talking to you and others about the design, it ended up being moved up to the top. I believe it's called the hub now.
Yeah, I think it's...
Did you have a strong feeling about that?
Well, I mean, I really think that it's more important. I'm all for scientific accuracy and tactical, you know, accuracy and logic. But there is more to be gained in excitement by putting the bridge and putting the command center in a place where you could say, they're in there. Yeah. You know, there was always I love Galactica, but there was always a disconnect because they never told you where the CIC was. It's buried deep within the ship, but you never got that sense of connection to where it was. I think it really helped to have the bridge up on top like that. It gives, what it gives the ship is a sense of scale, a sense of human scale. It's just a human connection, which I think really, really worked to the ship's advantage. The other thing is that it's very, very 21st century thinking to think, oh, we've got to bury this thing deep inside the ship to protect it. I think in that that day and age, burying it in the ship ain't going to help you. You know, you're going to have weaponry that's going to slice right through the ship, right to the middle.
Yeah.
And I've said this so many times, people keep thinking with their ape brain, that is, a ship is only as secure and sturdy and powerful as your structural integrity fields and your deflectors and stuff like that. If you lose those things, it doesn't matter where in the ship you are. Plus, the other thing is to consider, and I don't think many people do, is that if something really catastrophic happened to the ship, as a matter of fact, I could tell you that the Enterprise NX was designed this way, the bridge set module can come off like a lifeboat. The same with DS9, that little pill on top could come off, you know? So I like it out there. I like seeing it. I like knowing where it is. I you know, the idea of them, you know, it's like Gene always said, our people don't sneak around, you know. You don't bury them away. You put them out there and they hold their heads up high and they're, you know, we're Starfleet, goddammit.
Yeah, I agree with you from, yeah, wanting to see it out there. And then I also see David's perspective of thinking it should be buried. It's
won't help. It won't help.
Ultimately, though, I think.
Without the deflectors and stuff like that, the ship is like butter. It's like taking a blowtorch to butter. Doesn't matter. Putting the berry in. He's got to get that 21st century ape's brain out of here. Put the ape brain away. Come into the future with us.
Well, let me ask you one last thing related to production as we wrap up here. How do you see the future of these independent productions? You know, there's no Star Trek on television right now, but I feel confident that at some point in the future, CBS is going to either themselves produce or work with someone else to produce another Star Trek series. Do you think that, first of all, do you think that these productions like Star Trek Continues will find a wider acceptance amongst fans as we shift more and more towards this on-demand web-based delivery for television, which is actually how I get almost all my television.
Yeah,
now.
Me too.
And also, do you think that when Star Trek does come back to television officially, do you think that's going to curtail the fan interest in things like Continues?
Nope. Because no one, it's got to the point where no one is ever completely satisfied with what they do. Whether it's a TV show or a movie or it's a fan show. To have many choices is much more appealing to people. They like to have lots of choices. Paramount has never been able to give fans the original series back. So something like Star Trek Continues is like, you know, like manna from heaven. I mean, it's a thrill to watch it. It's something, you know, I've been lucky. I've worked on all this Star Trek and I've gotten Star Trek back and had hundreds of hours of Star Trek made. But as original fans, we never got back the one thing that we really wanted. That was the original series. So there's always going to be types of Star Trek that Paramount just isn't going to pull off, or they won't get to it. Or, you know, to think that would they ever do the original series again? I mean, I doubt it. But fans will continue to do it. You'll be able to go and visit that time and place that, you know, that you love so much. I'll tell you that if I was Paramount and I had some say, there's something going on here that, guys, you could take advantage of. You know, I mean, there's like reality TV shows where you can take the top three or four Star Trek fan films and pit them against one another and have a camera crew there and get it all on film and do a show like that. And then you put all four shows on television or stream on the internet, and you vote, and whoever wins gets real money. Maybe they get, you know, $1 million from Paramount towards their next one. And then
that's a cool idea.
Paramount can start streaming this stuff.
Yeah.
Something like Star Trek Continues, really cool Paramount idea. Should definitely jump on it.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we will see where it goes. There's so much excitement out there with everyone in these series. And as for you, Doug, you already mentioned that you're very busy on the television show right now. What are you working on now? What do you have coming up? And where can people go to find out more about your work?
Well, I mean, Facebook is always a good place to check in on me because I'm always putting stuff up there. And I have a lot of archives.
You put a lot of stuff on Facebook.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're a science fiction fan, a Galactica fan, a Star Trek fan, you know, come to my house. I've got lots of stuff to look at. But, right now, I'm working with my dear friend Gary Hutzel, who is our visual effects supervisor, who I've known for a long time now and met on The Next Generation. And I ended up doing CG models for him while I was in the art department for Deep Space Nine. And I remember, gee, Gary, that was fun. I hope we get to do that again. And he looked at me and he said, be careful what you wish for. And then a few years later, on the very night I heard Enterprise was canceled, I went home and there was a message from Gary Hutzel. And I'm like, oh my God, he's going to ask me to come to Galactica. And that's what it was. And we've been working together for a decade now and having a great time. What a great guy to work for. So we're working on Defiance, which is for sci-fi. And the first season was pretty good. It did well enough to be brought back. But I got to say, the second season really got some great fun stuff happening in it and some big stuff. So I think, you know, you should check it out. There's some good characters that you could fall in love with there. And I think that's what it's about. Look, I like spaceships. And we do have some space stuff in the show. But it's a post-apocalyptic thing that's very science fiction oriented, you know, not like Mad Max. And people should check it out. The second season starts up in like June, I think. We're starting to get there. And the shows are looking really, really good. And we're working on some stuff right now that's exciting. As a matter of fact, the pedal's to the metal and we're all doing some huge stuff. But anyway, I don't want to blather away too much here because I can't seem to shut up. So,
well, very cool. I'm looking forward to that. And definitely everyone go and check out Doug's Facebook page because he puts so much stuff up over there all the time. It's really, really great place. Well, Doug, thanks so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to talk to me today about Continues and about Star Trek. And it's just always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it. And it's always fun to talk to you.
Well, I hope everyone really enjoyed hearing Doug talk about creating Star Trek as well as how he became a fan. If you have not seen Star Trek Continues yet, I really encourage you to go over to the website at StarTrekContinues.com and you can watch the first two episodes there, Pilgrim of Eternity and Lolani, as well as the vignettes that were produced before the full episodes were released. You're really going to be blown away by what they're doing over there. Great performances, great writing. You'll really feel like you're watching TOS. And these are stories that you've just never seen before. And again, I really appreciate Doug taking some time out. He's very, very busy right now, but it's always fun to talk to him about the show and about the work and the creative behind it. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
The Enterprise.
Because if you break it down, you've got a flying saucer with rockets. It's everything that he was trying to avoid, but it's so much more than that.
He found a way to make a flying saucer with rockets make sense.
Earl Grey.
Encounter at Farpoint.
The alien ship is literally shooting at and killing colonists on the planet, and he's like...
I haven't had my talk-to-talk with Beverly yet.
The Ready Room.
Star Trek Continues.
Even on just seeing a corridor wall, you'll see, like, there's just a slash of red against the wall. That's a stylistic choice that they were making in that era. So Matt has a great eye while we're shooting a scene.
The Orb.
The full NDS9.
It's a milestone in the Cliff Bowl directing of Star Trek and Deep Space Nine. Defiant marks the final non-appearance of Sirach Lofton in a Cliff Bowl directed episode.
To the journey!
Innocence Rewrite.
We'll use a deflector dish to emit a tachyon beam, fire a few photon torpedoes, blow up the anomaly of the week, and then we'll just fly off into space like we do at the end of every week.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Remembering Cliff Bowl with Larry Nemechek.
But the thing about Cliff personally was, that I'll always remember, and it comes through in this transcript, he's a pretty plain-spoken guy. And he would call a spade. And what's your rating on this podcast? Are you pretty much up to...
Warp 5.
Prequel design.
Or just, you know, for the sake of the actor, so they felt like, in the design people, they felt like this was a real place that people would believe. And I just really appreciate that.
Literary Treks.
John Jackson Miller, Absent Enemies.
And of course, the larger thing about the whole phasing thing is it allowed me to tell a story that I think had a Star Trek feel to it, with regard to, the issue of war and peace.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week. And some days we even have two shows for you. And you'll find them in a wide variety of places, including on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from our website. So go grab some shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. Now, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's show, on Doug's work on Star Trek Continues, anything you want to talk about, you can do that in several ways. You can go to our website at trek.afilm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Continuing Mission, and that will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.afilm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about Star Trek. If you're in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and you'll find us on Twitter under username trekfm, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek. If you'd like to find me, I'm also on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network here, you'll find me on Literary Treks with Matthew Rushing, where we talk about Star Trek books and comics. On The Orb, again with Matthew, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine. I'm on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. And I have my own interview show, MatterStream. In addition, we have a big show called The Ready Room, which I host along with other hosts from all across the network and special guests, where every week we talk about Star Trek news and all 5 live-action Star Trek series. So those are some of the shows we have for you. Go check them out, and I'm sure we have something for every Star Trek fan across those shows. Before I let you go, I'd like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, and that's Audible.com. Audible is the best source for audiobooks you'll find online. They have over 150,000 books on there right now, and they add hundreds of new books every single week. I've been an Audible customer myself for 14 years. I just couldn't get by without them. If you're not listening to audiobooks already, and you like podcasts, you are going to love audiobooks. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up, you can choose any book you want. And if after the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, you get to keep that book. So there's nothing to lose. But your support of Audible helps us keep all of our shows coming to you every week. So go check it out. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really appreciate Audible's support of Continuing Mission and the network. Thanks again for tuning in today, everyone, and join me again next time on this continuing mission, and let's see what's out there.